Okay. Very good. Good morning, everyone. See, many familiar faces here. It's very nice. I just arrived very early this morning here at Bandaravela. I just came straight from the airport. So if my talk this morning is a bit rambling and a bit dodgy, then you know why that is the case. But it's always nice to come here to Sri Lanka, and wonderful to see so many familiar faces again. So the idea with this retreat, as always, is to do some study of the suttas. I always like to go back to the word of the Buddha when I study the Dhamma. There's too many people in the world who take everybody else as their teacher, except for the Buddha himself. And I think it's very useful as a Buddhist to go back to the word of the Buddha. It doesn't mean that we cannot take contemporary teachers as our teacher as well. Of course we can. But to kind of base ourselves in the word of the Buddha, I think is very useful. Because it gives you a grounding. It gives you a gold standard by which everything else can be judged. And when I do these retreats, I like to have a theme for these retreats. Last year we were looking at the Noble Eightfold Path. And previously I have been looking at the gradual training, the very famous gradual training that you find in the suttas. This year I thought of looking at dependent origination as a framework for the talks. And that does not mean that I want to make it very theoretical. I don't want it to be a very theoretical retreat where all we do is discuss, is it momentary? Is it one lifetime? Is it three lifetimes? That sort of thing. It's not about philosophy. It's about the idea of all the teachings of the Buddha, including dependent origination, including those things that may seem philosophical. The purpose is always practice, right? The purpose points you in the right direction, to get yourself going, to do what needs to be done, to overcome suffering, overcome defilements, and achieve some real happiness in life. This is the purpose of all of these teachings. So dependent origination is just a framework, and the idea then is to use that to actually look at how this teaching can be used in practice. So not to philosophize too much, although a little bit of philosophizing is perhaps necessary, because it is quite profound in certain places, and I think we need to discuss some of those profundities as well, because it is really the kind of essence, the outlook of the Buddha, how he looks at the world. And for that reason, it is, of course, very interesting in its own right. So roughly the first half of the retreat, I will be going through dependent origination. And then in the second half, I will be doing things that are a bit more practical, a bit more to do with how to work with the mind and that sort of thing. But for this morning, I just wanted to give some very basic instructions, first of all, and maybe read out one sutta or so, see what happens as we go along. Just to have some basic foundation for the meditation instructions is the first thing I'd like to do. And one of the principles that I always like to use when I think about meditation is that always there's one basic thing that the suttas always come back to, and that is the idea that meditation is supposed to be a happy, a pleasant, a relaxing, an easeful experience. That is the idea of meditation practice. And in monastic life, the real pleasure of monastic life is really meditation practice, right? So if you can't find your pleasure there, if you can't find your happiness there, it is unlikely that you will find all that much happiness in monastic life. It makes it much more difficult. So it's important that we kind of guide our mind towards some degree of happiness in the meditation practice. And if you use that underlying idea of moving towards happiness, moving away from suffering, you have a very powerful tool for deciding how to go about things, when you're heading in the right direction, when you're going in the wrong direction, etc. It's a very, very useful tool. So please use this for these 9 days here. Use this throughout your life, as far as I'm concerned. That's the way I like to look at these things. Because then you have a kind of an overarching idea of what meditation is all about. And I will show you later on this morning how that is also expressed in the suttas themselves. And one of the, how this actually bears out in practice, to start off with, one of the ways that it bears out is that I always tell people, I'm just going to be very quick on this, foundational things, but I always say that one of the most important things is to be comfortable in your meditation. This is one of those kind of crucial things, right? And it's one of those things that we tend to forget so easily, that we sit with too much pain, and the mind sometimes gets obsessed with that pain. And when the mind gets obsessed with the pain, it's very, very hard to move on. So this is one of those big problems. And I recommend people generally to be comfortable in your meditation experience, in your meditation practice when you sit down. Sit in a way whereby you feel at ease and you feel relaxed. And this is really, when you think about it, this is the very first teaching the Buddha gave in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. Right? He starts off, the very first thing he says is the middle way. And yet despite the fact that the Buddha, this is the very first teaching that he gives, it is so easy to forget that very basic teaching. No need to torture the body, no need to create artificial pain, just as we shouldn't indulge the body. We should find that middle way. And there's something very powerful about that, because when you find the middle way between, on the one hand, indulgence, on the other hand, pain, what happens is that the body starts to disappear. The body becomes irrelevant, right? If there is pain in the body, there's something to be done. You want to sort out the pain. You want to get rid of that. If there is pleasure to be had through the body, of course, again, the body is important because you find pleasure there. But when you find neither pleasure nor pain, the body starts to fade away. It's really quite simple. It's almost not like a middle way. It's almost like the two extremes are part of the experience of the body, in a sense. And when you go past the two extremes, the middle way is the way of the mind, the way of mental development. That's why the middle way, of course, includes the satipatthanas, includes the jhana experience, samasamadhi, and all that. This is the mind mental development devoid of the body. So this is really the first thing. So just, enjoy. Make sure you don't create additional suffering, right? Enough suffering in life already. Is anyone who hasn't got enough suffering in life? And then we sit down and we kind of create more. Just make sure we have enough suffering in life. Sometimes that's what happens. And it reminds you of that famous sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Devadaha Sutta, where the Buddha is talking to all the Jains, right? And the Jains, they're sitting on these burning hot rocks in the middle of the sun, in the middle of the day. I'm sure you know how hot it can get in the north of India. It gets even hotter than it gets in Sri Lanka, I believe. Sometimes. I think this year they had a record heat of over 50 degrees. So these Jain ascetics, they would go out in the middle of the day on the burning rocks in the sun, stand on one leg or whatever, and all these kind of weird things. And the Buddha, and they say, oh, we're burning off all kama. And the Buddha says to them, well, maybe you're feeling these feelings because you are sitting on a burning hot rock in the middle of the day. Maybe that's the reason why you're feeling these feelings. So this is kind of the Jain way of practice, right? Where you deliberately create these painful feelings. And it's not really the Buddhist way. The Buddhist way is really to transcend all that. And that comes out very clearly in the Devadaha Sutta, in the Majjhima Nikaya, if you want to have a look at that one. So that is the very first thing, finding that body which doesn't have any pain. Very simple teaching, very obvious in many ways, but still many people forget this, even in Buddhism. And then once the body is not too painful, you're finding that middle way, the second thing to do is to, of course, relax everything, to feel at ease, right? This also, in a sense, is the middle way. If the body is tense, it is basically a physical problem. So again, it's not the middle way. So find that ease in the body where you feel relaxed, right? One of the things about meditation practice is to find a sense of relaxation, a sense of ease that is more profound than any sense of ease that you normally have. So you spend that time to find that ease. Spend that time just really, just feel the peace, feel the beauty of the meditation, allow everything to settle down. And when you do that, you find yourself almost magnetically drawn towards the meditation, because it is more pleasurable, more happy, more easeful than what ordinary life is like. So very obvious in a sense, but I think often people neglect that. What often people do, they sit down to meditate and they go to the breath straight away. But going to the breath straight away is not going to work. And the reason is because if you read the Anapanasati Sutta, it says, first of all, you should establish mindfulness, right? So you have to allow everything to calm down, to become easeful and peaceful, and then you can really start watching the breath. It shouldn't be a holding on to the breath. It should be an easy observance, an easy awareness. That is when it works out in the right way. And of course, to be able to really relax, to really be at ease, one of the most important things is the attitude we have in meditation practice. And you see this throughout the suttas. The Buddha's talks about certain attitudes. I call it attitudes. You can call it many things if you like. And he talks about the silanusati, right? Silanusati is one of the foundational practices that you feel happy with yourself. You feel kind of a sense of gladness about your conduct in the world. And when you feel that happiness with yourself, then of course that is the kind of attitude, right? You come into meditation and think, yeah, good. I'm living a good life. I'm doing something good by meditating. The attitude is right. And then, of course, meditation becomes possible. Chaganusati, Silanusati, Buddha Dhamma Sanghanusati, etc. They are very common teachings in the suttas, and all of them are there for one reason, to bring that happiness, to bring that joy into existence, right? And then the meditation starts to happen as a consequence. So this is the attitude, and then you find yourself becoming very peaceful, very relaxed, very at ease, and the joy and gladness starts to arise in the mind as well here. This is it, right? You may have heard this already because I think I was told you played some other talk that I've given before here. So just repeating these things, because sometimes I think these things kind of bear repeating here. This is my attitude to meditation. So you can just, you know, it's really up to you whether you what you want to make of that. So that is really all I'm going to say about that, especially because you have heard these things before. And now I thought what I would do next is to actually start out on these suttas that I have collected for this retreat. I'm going to start off with just a sutta on meditation practice. This is not really related to dependent origination as such. It's more like by way of background and way of kind of informing the overall approach. This is one of my favorite suttas in the Nikayas. And of course, the question often arises, how do we choose good suttas? Which suttas are actually important in the Nikayas? What are the ones that matter, right? This is, I think, a very important question. And the reason it is important is because sometimes there is a tendency in Buddhist circles to take out the obscure suttas, the obscure teachings that nobody really understands properly, that maybe occur one place, right? Anidasana Vijnana or something like that. And a very obscure phrase that occurs twice in the suttas, and discuss that in great detail. Of course, it may be interesting, but I think the main emphasis in the suttas should always be on those teachings that are taught again and again and again, that you see throughout the suttas, the ones that the Buddha would have taught to many different assemblies, many different monastics, many different lay people, in many different places, in many different situations. And often he would teach the same teaching here, but he will give it a slightly different slant, right? A slightly different angle. And when you add together all those different angles and slants, you start to get a very comprehensive understanding of that teaching. And so those are the most important teachings, right? And of course, those teachings can often be summarized in the 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas, because the Buddha himself said, this is the teaching you should remember after passing away. He says that in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. These are the teachings. This is the Dhamma. This is kind of the essence of what I have taught. And any other teachings as well in the suttas that kind of bear out those basic principles that you find with the Bodhipakya Dhammas. And any sutta that occur again and again and again. And this particular sutta I'm going to read out is one of those suttas that is very common. This form I'm going to read out here is a particular form of that sutta. It occurs in many different forms, but this is one particular form. not only does it occur in many places in the Pali Nikayas, but what is very interesting about the sutta as well, it also occurs in Chinese, for example. And it's very interesting to compare these suttas into the ancient languages. And this one here has recently been translated. It exists in the Madhyama Agama in Chinese, been translated by Venerable Analayo, a German scholar and meditator. And what is very fascinating about this is that when you read those two translations side by side, right, we're talking about here lineages. We're talking about the Theravada lineage or the Pali lineage on the one hand. On the other hand, we're talking about the Chinese, which comes from the Sarvastivadin lineage. And these lineages are generally understood to have parted from each other around the time of Ashoka. Ashoka lived, it's now almost 2,300 years ago, right? We're maybe within 150 years of the lifetime of the Buddha himself, perhaps, depending on when we think the Buddha lived. But so what is so fascinating about this? When you compare recensions that have been orally transmitted in separate lineages for so long, 2,300 years, right? Part of that transmission would have been orally, part of it would have been written down. But if you compare them today, they are virtually identical. And this sutta is one of those suttas which actually is, it's hard to see a different word in the entire sutta when you read them. And that is astonishing, right? That this really is kind of mind-blowing. How is it possible to be able to transmit a sutta so accurately that it is virtually word for word the same today as it was at least 2,300 years ago, probably all the way back to the Buddha himself. And it gives you this feeling that you are in the presence of the Buddha, right? You may doubt the suttas, you may doubt the transmission, but when you see this consistency in transmission through that comparative study, it gives you this very powerful feel. This is the word of the Buddha. And that is kind of slightly hair-raising, right? It's like, here is the Buddha, he's talking to me. It's not kind of some words on the page anymore. It's actually the real thing. The Buddha is right there. When you open that book, when you read that sutta, it's not just word on the page. It's the Buddha talking to you, telling you, this is how my teaching is. This is what you should be doing here. So this is just by way of preamble, just to give you some idea of how I consider which teachings are important. And I try to make it objective. I mean, it's very hard to make this 100% objective because everything in life is subjective to some extent. But you try to make it reasonably objective so that you don't just take on, oh, this is my favorite sutta, and you take on your delusion into the suttas, right? Which always is unfortunate. So you try to kind of leave that delusion to one side and focus on what the Buddha himself said. So that is the just the background. So let me read it out for you, and then I will comment on it afterwards. So many of you will have no doubt heard of this sutta before. I read the sutta out every time I do a retreat somewhere. So if you are fed up with the sutta, that's fair enough. I don't blame you for that. But anyway, here we go. This sutta is called Volition, which would probably is Chaitana in Pali. Bhikkhus, for a virtuous person, one whose behavior is virtuous, no volition need be exerted. Let non-regret arise in me. It is natural that non-regret arises in one who is virtuous, one whose behavior is virtuous. For one without regret, no volition need be exerted. Let joy arise in me. It is natural that joy arises in one without regret. For one who is joyful, no volition need be exerted. Let rapture arise in me. It is natural that rapture arises in one who is joyful. For one with a rapturous mind, no volition need be exerted. Let my body become tranquil. It is natural that the body of one with a rapturous mind is tranquil. For one tranquil in body, no volition need be exerted. Let me feel pleasure or happiness. It is natural that one tranquil in body feels happiness. One feeling happiness, no volition need be exerted. Let my mind be stilled. It is natural that the mind of one feeling happiness is stilled. For one who is sealed, no volition need be exerted. Let me know and see things as they really are. It is natural that one who is sealed knows and sees things as they really are. So there you are. And sometimes when I read the sutta out, you know, I ask sometimes, sometimes I give teachings to retreats where there's only lay people around, and I say to them, I ask them, well, what do you think? What do you think about that? And the first thing they say, oh, boring. Just one thing after the other. So it looks really, really boring. But of course, the point is that if you understand how this works, what this repetition actually does, which is very powerful about it, is that it makes certain words stand out. Because it is so repetitive, it means that everything which is not repeated, right? There's one word which isn't repeated all the way through. That one word kind of stands out. And that, of course, is the sequence that matters here. And once you see that sequence, you take out those words that are not repeated in everyone, you see that this is very close to the bhujangas, the factors of awakening. It's almost exactly the same sequence as the bhujangas. It's a slight variation on the bhujangas, and that's why I said before, this really belongs with the bodhipakya dhammas, because it's just an alternative way of understanding the arising of the bhujangas, really. But it is a bit more than just the bhujangas, because it is a sequence that starts all the way from virtue, so it goes further back, it goes in back to more basic things. So because of that, it has a bit more applicability to us than the bhujangas sometimes have. Now, one of the most beautiful things about this sequence that you see straight away when you read this, is this extraordinary emphasis on happiness, right? Happiness, joy, rapture, non-regret, tranquility, samadhi, which I translate as stillness there. All of that is, it is so ingrained, right? It's so kind of, everything is about happiness one way or another. Or if you like, the abandoning of dukkha, which is basically the same thing here. And this is such a positive message. Here is one of the core teachings of the Buddha. And of course, it's not just this teaching. It is in so many places. The core message is one of happiness. It is so, when you read this, of course, if you read the Four Noble Truths, sometimes people get depressed, especially those who are beginners in Buddhism. They think, oh, it's all about suffering, you know, not sure if I want to be a Buddhist. So it depends what you read. But here is a sutta which has the exact opposite message. It's so positive, so beautiful, so uplifting, right? This is where we're all heading here. If you are practicing this path properly here, if you are doing what you're supposed to do, whether you are a monastic or you are a lay person, this is what you have in front of you. Wow, it is just so, such a wonderful message. How can anyone not be a monastic? How can anyone not practice this path seriously? It makes you wonder. Here is everything that anyone could ever want in their whole life. Is right there in this one little sutta found, tucked away in the Anguttara Nikaya. What a wonderful message that is. And this is one of the things that kind of stand out in the sutta sometimes. The message is so incredibly positive, and it's very hard to find that in any other aspect of life, basically, or any other kind of philosophy or teaching in quite the same way. So this is important to see, especially if you sometimes, you know, you focus too much on the dukkha aspect of Buddhism. It's important to understand the flip side of that coin, which happens through meditation practice. The other thing which this thing is all about, which is very important in this particular sequence, of course, is the idea this is really how each one of us should ideally experience the path, right? Experience meditation itself. So these are like the signposts on the way here. You could call this, some people like to call it the psychology of meditation, or the personal experience of meditation, how these things actually are experienced. This is what this is about. So very useful, right? We all need to have a map. We need to have kind of everything kind of connected. Sometimes I like to think of the Buddhist teaching as a jigsaw puzzle where all the pieces fit together. It's not really a jigsaw puzzle because it's a picture which overlaps and everything else. It's more complicated than that. But it kind of gives a rough idea. So it gives a rough idea of where we're heading. And for that, of course, again, very important and quite important to understand what these terms are pointing to. why they have that particular sequence, so you can start to recognize them in your own practice. It's like when you want to travel to Colombo, you kind of follow the sign that says, okay, 100 kilometers to Colombo, 50 kilometers, 25, right? And if you start to see that the sign says, 50 kilometers to Gaul instead, then, well, you know you're heading in the wrong direction. Same kind of idea. So same principle. You have the signposts on the way that are kind of making sure you're heading there. Of course, it is important here not to take those signposts into the meditation. The idea is just to have this at the back of your mind so you know where you are heading, where you are going with this. It's not something that you actually need to think about as such in your meditation practice. It's just something that you have there. It's kind of sitting there to guide you at the back of your mind. So that is an important aspect of this teaching. The idea that it is a very good guidance for what we're supposed to do. Now the third thing that stands out about this teaching is this thing that it says here that the way it is translated here, no volition need be exerted. The Pali for that is na chetanaya karaniya. And if you know the Pali, na chetanaya karaniya means it cannot be done or should not be done by volition. That's basically what it means. So it means it cannot be done by volition, right? This is a sequence where volition actually is redundant. Volition is the will. Volition is the doer inside. Volition is the activity that we have inside of us. And this sequence does not come into being through our doing, through our acting, through our willing. And that, of course, is very interesting, because most of the things that people do in their life, apart perhaps from the monastic life or the meditation practice, is all about doing. It's about applying yourself. It's about using your mind to kind of guide yourself and force yourself into the right direction. And here, we're doing the exact opposite. Instead of using willpower, we're saying, actually, it cannot be done through willpower. It means that if you use willpower, you're probably getting in the way, right? Willpower is wrong. The volition can't actually do this. So we have to go the exact opposite of how people normally live their lives. We have to withdraw the will, withdraw those things that usually guide everything we do. And because we are so used to that, because this is such a big part of how we live, how we have our habits, etc., it's actually, this is one of the reasons why it is difficult, why meditation can be difficult. Because it is a new direction. It's a new thing you have to do. You have to learn to be aware, to be attentive, without actually doing anything here. And it's quite hard sometimes to do that. Thoughts come in, right? Where do the thoughts come from? The thoughts come from the will, of course, from the volition, from the activity of the mind itself. And this is very, to me, has always been very kind of very interesting, because it's also very nice, right? If you don't have to do anything, it's actually very pleasant. You can just sit back and you can just enjoy. There's nothing that you have to do. And of course, one of the things that most of you who have meditated for a while will recognize is that the less you do in your meditation, the more beautiful it is. Right, the more peaceful it is, the more nice it is. And you start to understand that all this doing actually is a pain. It's a part of dukkha, it's an aspect of dukkha. And when you withdraw that, actually that's when energy starts to arise. That's when beauty, that's when piti and all of these other wonderful activity, wonderful qualities of mind start to arise as a consequence. So it's one of those amazing things that it is right there. But you can see how easy it is to misunderstand. No volition need be exerted is a translation by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhina. But I would translate it more strongly than that, as this cannot be done through an act of will or something like that. And I think you are more in tune with the what the Pali actually says. And then, of course, it says, it is natural, right? This is dhammata, in accordance with nature. This thing just happens. If it is in accordance with nature, it means that there's nothing you have to do. All you have to do is set in place, the right causes, and then everything else happens as a consequence. It's a natural thing. It must happen. Whoa. Relax, enjoy, right? And again, it's a very very nice message, and very a beautiful message as far as I can, as I read it. So those are the kind of some of the overall ideas in this short little sutra. Now, one of the things that, of course, always is an important point when you have a natural sequence like that, where one thing leads to the next one, step by step, then the points of importance are the initial point, right? Because the initial point is where everything else happens from. If everything else is a natural consequence of the initial point becomes really important. This is where the work is to be done. And of course, the end point is also interesting here. So we have a quick look at the end point as well, because where all this is heading, although the initial point is probably more more useful for immediate purposes, at least. So the initial point here is the thing that sets this whole thing off is that a person is virtuous. And of course, the Pali word for virtuous here is sila, right? So it's the silavanto person, the one who has virtue, is the one that is meant here. So this is the critical aspect. So if you have ever wondered, why is it when I sit back, I just relax, I'm just taking it easy, I'm just trying to have fun, right? But it isn't happening. Where is the joy? Where is the happiness? And then, of course, the answer is right there. The answer is, the reason is because your sila isn't yet purified enough. That is the reason. The answer is right there. It's very obvious. And you may think, well, but I feel quite pure. I feel quite good. So what's going on? And of course, the point there is that the defilements of the mind are often very subtle. Attachment to the body, attachment to the five senses, attachment to the pleasures in the world can often have quite a subtle form to them. And that is why it is can be very hard to see here. It's important here to understand that when we're talking about sila in the Pali language, the way I understand sila is that it is more, the English word virtue just means that you don't do too many bad things, right? It doesn't really capture sila, in my opinion. The idea here, unfortunately, neither English nor Pali is my native language. I'm a bit on thin ice here. But the idea with sila is that it has to do with your habits, with your character, with who you are as a person. That's how I understand this term. It's very, very broad. And that's why in the suttas they talk about things like the Indriya Sangvara Sutta, Sila. Indriya Sangvara Sila, right? Which is a mental thing. It doesn't have anything to do with our external conduct. So it's very, very broad. It's about how our entire personality. So this is what really Sila is about. It's about learning to change your character, to change who you are as a person, and move into a place where you are, not only do you speak kindly and you act kindly, and of course you avoid the bad things, but also you think kindly, right? You don't think the bad things. All of it is also part of that. And of course, if you have a mind of metta, and you have a mind of kindness, you have a mind which is understanding, which has time for other people, which doesn't get upset very easily, which is compassionate, understanding the suffering in the world, all of these kind of things, then of course you can understand why sila is really the foundation for this whole thing here. And of course then you can do the sila nusati. I was talking about the sila nusati before. And of course the way to do the sila nusati then, you just sit back. And you sit back and you wait for all those good actions, all the things you have done in your life. They just come back to you and you feel a natural sense of gladness. And then based on that natural sense of gladness, this whole sequence then takes off as a consequence. So sila is really the crucial issue, and for that reason, because it is so broad, and because sila is almost everything up until you get to samadhi. Once you get to samadhi, at that point, your sila has been purified. But remember, if you read the Satipatthana Sutta also is really about sila, right, to a very large extent. Satipatthana is all about learning how to overcome the hindrances, how to overcome attachment to the body, right? These things are very important aspects of Satipatthana. So that too is really about sila. So the whole path is a Visuddhi Magga, the Visuddhi Magga of the suttas, not the Visuddhi Magga of Buddha Gosa, but of the Buddha himself. The whole path is the Visuddhi Magga, and for that, and this is where why sila is so important as a very initial aspect here. And then very briefly as well, at the very end, it says that samadhi is the condition for yathabhuta nyanadasana, and it is translated here as concentrated. I translate it as stilled, and the reason I translate it as stilled is because my teacher translates it as stilled, and these things are recorded, right? Because they're recorded, he might get to hear them. And if I translate as concentrated, I might get in serious trouble in my monastery back in Perth, so I have to translate as stilled. That's why I do that. Oh, maybe we should delete that from the recording, but might be counterproductive. No, but anyway, I think there is a point to that. I think still, for me, is a more meaningful and more useful word than the idea of concentrated, which kind of often has an idea of force of mind rather than just being at peace and being at ease. But of course, the important point here, remember we're talking here about a sutta which is repeated like this in so many places in the sutta, so many places you find this. And it says here, it is the stilled mind that sees things as they really are. It's from samadhi you get yathabhuta nyanadasana. It's such an important message, right? It's so fundamental. It's right there in the suttas. And yet, still, even today, I feel that it is often neglected too much. It's a basic thing, and is often neglected and not really fully appreciated the importance of that. So please keep that in mind. Yata Buddha Nanadasana comes from Samadhi, a very important one here. So let's have a look at these factors, maybe just briefly, just go through them one by one, just to have some idea of what is going on here. Many of you will know these things already, but it's probably useful to do that. So it starts off with your character, right? Your behavior, your sila, and from the sila arises non-regret, right? Non-regret. Non-regret is, of course, is this feeling that you have lived your life well. You feel happy about yourself. It doesn't just mean that you say, "Oh no, I did this thing. I shouldn't have done that. I'm a bad person." It doesn't mean just that, right? It means a sense of not having any burdens in the mind. Regret is like having a burden inside of you, which holds you down. It's like the sandbags which tie down a balloon, doesn't allow it to soar. In the same way, your mind doesn't soar because it has all these weights that hold it down. And this is regret. It darkens your mind a little bit, takes away the piti, takes away the energy, takes away the mindfulness, and this makes life just generally more miserable. So, and you can feel that inside of yourself, and I would recommend everybody to feel these things. Feel how your actions actually affect your mind straight away. We talk about the ditta dhamma kamma, the kamma in this very life. This to me is what is meant by the ditta dhamma kamma, is the feelings, how it affects the mind straight away, and for that reason also for the rest of your life, all the actions that you do. Once you start to see that, I will talk more about this later on, but once you start to see that, it has a very, I think, a powerful motivating effect on you not to do anything which isn't quite right. You're almost repelled by the negative things, and you are attracted towards doing what is good instead. Then when you have no regret, then joy arises. Pamuja comes as a consequence of no regret. Right, pamuja is this idea of gladness. You're just happy about yourself. You feel a sense of gladness inside. This is how I understand this term. You just feel a sense of joy about, you know, your step is light. You feel things are kind of going well for you. When you sit down, you don't have any darkness. Your mind is quite bright and quite happy and energetic because you feel glad. And then remember, this now is all automatic, right? So all you are doing, you're sitting down, following your meditation object, whatever that is, the breath or whatever it is, and these things just arise as a consequence. Nothing you have to do. So gladness is there. So you're watching the breath, the gladness is there. And because you have done your work, you have done the sila, you have consolidated those habits and good characters for a long time, for years, right? Many of you here have been monks for a long, long time. And you have consolidated for a long time, and if you haven't consolidated enough yet, you will do so in the future, and you will bring it to fruition. And then because of that, because the power of the mind is there, gradually the gladness becomes more powerful, and it merges into piti, which here is translated as rapture. And of course, the rapture is where that gladness becomes more powerful and often felt in the body as a physical sensation, right? You feel like this kind of beautiful current almost going through the body. This is kind of the rapture thing here. And I'm sure many of you here will have experienced that. Maybe all of you even occasionally experience these kind of feelings, right? It feels very fast. It feels very nice at this particular point. Things are going really well. So you feel these currents going through the body, and you keep on watching the breath. And if your sila is powerful enough, if all the groundwork has been done, then it will just carry on. Nothing you do, you just wait. And the rapture starts to die down, and you start to feel tranquil, right? You start to feel peaceful. And this tranquility is where the body just becomes like rock solid. You're just sitting there. You feel like this. You don't want to go anywhere else anymore. This is what tranquility is like, right? You feel just so happy to be here. You don't want to go anywhere else. Sense of peace and ease in the present moment. And you often find that the meditation may go through some kind of some kind of curve. And at the height of it, it becomes very, very, very beautiful and peaceful. And then gradually it comes out again afterwards. This is often how how people often experience the meditation itself. And then, of course, with that tranquility, or you could say as the tranquility is developed further, comes an even more profound sense of happiness, a deep sense of satisfaction that comes inside. And of course, that deep sense of satisfaction means that the mind is not looking for happiness anywhere else. It's no longer desiring anything, but looking for anything inside, outside. And because it isn't looking for anything outside, it means the mind becomes stilled. It's perfectly content in the present moment, perfectly happy with what it has. It is stilled right here, right now. And this is where the samadhi comes. And the samadhi comes then, when samadhi has come, then the hindrances are abandoned in the profound way. Then, of course, the yatha bhuta nanadasana becomes possible as a consequence. And I'm not going to take it any further than that. Of course, this sequence then continues on all the way to vimutti, to liberation, eventually. But if you can get to yatha bhuta nanadasana, wow, you're doing really, really well, and you're coming towards the end of the path already at that stage, really, as I understand this path. So, there you are. That is that little sutta on volition, very powerful, very attractive little sutta. And as I was saying at the beginning, is that meditation should always be about some kind of happiness, some kind of reduction in suffering, some form of ease, right? And if you start off with torturing yourself a little bit, having too much pain in the body, your knees are hurting, your back is hurting, but you're going to kind of push through it and see what happens. If you do too much of that, there's no way you're going to be able to access these beautiful states. Unless you are already very skilled in samadhi, then maybe you can do it. But for the majority of people who haven't got that skill in samadhi, actually, the people I know who are really skilled in samadhi, they never torture themselves. The way they do, they kind of sit back, relax, take it easy, and when they feel ready and everything is nice and easy, that's when they kind of move towards samadhi. That is my experience of these things. So remember that, because then that becomes a guide for not only for how to do this particular practice, but also for how to get started, how to get into this, right? And then hopefully that will be something that you can use in your entire Buddhist life. Okay, so I think I will stop there for this morning, because I'm not perhaps 100% recovered yet from my overnight driving, but let's maybe stop at that particular point. Okay.